Just who is the gold statue at Providence and Queens? What is the mysterious four-story glass structure being built on South Boulevard? Which national chains got their start in the Charlotte area? Vote for your favorite question and the FAQ City podcast will answer it on WFAE.org/FAQ City. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tom Dooley has been a legend around these parts for 150 years because of some very bad behavior. Today, the Tom Dooley Project puts those bad deeds to a good purpose, and we hear about that later in the program. First, let's take a walk. Not just for the exercise, but to learn something. That's the concept behind Charlotte City Walks, which take participants through various neighborhoods to learn more about their history, provide a present-day snapshot, and to help connect people across those neighborhoods. Those walks are led by historians, and we have one of them with us right now. Tom Hanchett is community historian, formerly with the Levine Museum of the New South. He now writes the monthly Food from Home column in the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back, stranger. Where you
Good
been?
Good to be here. Good to be here.
You've been a stranger for quite a while, so stop it. nice to have you here. Amiene Wright is Assistant Director of Communications at Johnson C. Smith University and is co-leading a walk around that neighborhood surrounding the school, I believe, with Tom. Is that right?
I sure am.
Well, nice to have you here, too.
Thank you.
And Angelique Gaines is a social research specialist at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, who has been organizing these walks for several years. Welcome back to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
These city walks have been conducted for about 7 years now, I think. Who came up with the idea, Angelique?
So this movement has been going on for quite some time now. These walks are inspired by Jane Jacobs. She's an urbanist, a city activist, and this is a global movement. It takes place in over 200 cities around the world. We really wanted to get behind this. It started with Tom Hanchett leading one walk in 2012, and now it has grown to 20-plus walks. This year, it's going to be close to 30. So,
yeah, Jane Jacobs. We've actually talked about Jane Jacobs, and I don't remember when, but we did it on this program. She was a New Yorker,
mm-hmm.
Turn of the last century, the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
and started these walks.
She was an urbanist at a point when women weren't supposed to do anything outside the home.
Okay.
And she took on Robert Moses, who was the biggest, baddest highway builder in the New York City area. And she helped save Greenwich Village and at a point when historic preservation didn't exist. And she would be famous for all of that, but she wrote this book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And she said, look at how cities actually work rather than looking at the drawings that planners create, and celebrate what you got. And at that time, nobody thought anything about Greenwich Village. It was just old.
And that time was when?
This is back in the 50s.
Okay.
And she has inspired all of city planning since then. And she passed away several years ago, right. But there's an international Jane Jacobs organization. And Mary Newsom, who runs the Plan Charlotte blog at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, is a big fan of the Jane Jacobs movement and put together these walking tours that happen every May.
So in case I wasn't clear about this in the opening, what exactly are these walks? What exactly is a city walk, Angelique?
Well, they are citizen-led or resident-led walking tours that happen throughout the month of May, and they're free. So anyone that wants to register and sign up for a walk
gets to lead them? Who makes that decision?
Anybody.
Anyone.
Really? So I could lead one through my cul-de-sac.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
And Mike, I actually led my first walk last year, and it was a wonderful time. Tom, well, I co-led it because Tom brought me in and co-led it with me. And it was really fascinating because not only did I get to teach other people about my neighborhood, Macquarie Heights, which I love,
mm-hmm.
but I also got to learn a lot about my neighborhood, and I got to meet people from completely different sectors of the city. And it just really, it fosters a real sense of like ownership and like community building together.
That's one of the reasons that people who are behind this movement are behind it, because it builds mm-hmm. connections. And in a city like Charlotte, where we are disconnected, mm-hmm. this is a way to just begin to know the other exists and then to learn about that other person?
Right, right.
That other neighborhood?
Charlotte is a city, is a city of transplants. I'm a transplant. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, you can connect to a place, but you know, just by loving your home and loving your immediate neighbors, but not know the full history of a place. Mm-hmm. And when you have these city walks and you start to go to unfamiliar neighborhoods and then you learn the history of them, the people mm-hmm. who lived there, what happened, what transpired there, you just feel so much more rooted in the city.
So McCrory Heights, which is your stomping grounds,
mm-hmm.
not named after the former mayor, former governor.
No, sir. Named after the former president of Johnson C. Smith University.
And spelled differently, too, with an extra E. With an E. McCrory. McCrory Heights.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Well, there you go. Let's take a walk.
Brand new.
So, as an historian, why are these important,
Tom? We think we don't have history in this city. And we really do. And part of it is we have a very rich history of 20th century neighborhoods. When I came to Charlotte back in the 80s to work for the Landmarks Commission, people didn't really respect bungalow neighborhoods. Dilworth, you know, why would you be interested in Dilworth? Myers Park, well, that's just an old neighborhood. And what has begun to happen now is we're beginning to appreciate neighborhoods from the middle of the 20th century. And McCrory Heights, an amazing neighborhood that was laid out by the president of Johnson C. Smith and mostly built up in the 50s and 60s, has all these ranch houses that are absolutely pristine, which is not those two words, ranch house and pristine, mm-hmm. I would never have put into a sentence 20 years ago. But that, you know, we're at a different point now in our architecture, in our history. And so just architecturally, it's a beautiful neighborhood, and it really feels like the mid-20th century. But mm-hmm. Amine's neighbors are some of the folks who led the civil rights movement in Charlotte.
And isn't one of the houses in that neighborhood one of the first houses that Harvey Gantt?
Right at the corner of my block, yes.
Really?
Yes.
What is it about? Because you're right. We don't appreciate. I grew up in a mid-20th century house, and I look back on it and think, it's a mid-20th century house. But things get a different patina with age, with time. People begin to appreciate what they didn't appreciate before. What is it about the mid-20th century that is now emerging as appreciable, if that is the right word?
Well, we went through a period in the late 20th, early 21st century where we liked houses. The more gables the house had, the better the house was. Mm-hmm. Just more complex, kind of neo-Victorian. And you get into complexity, and you have to pay for the gables, and you have to paint the gables, and you start looking at simplicity. And Mad Men on television helped people understand that there's a mid-20th century aesthetic that's really cool. And that is part of what's driving this interest in the mid-20th century neighborhoods. The other is that what was built at the edge of town is now fairly well located, and young people are looking for those kind of places.
Yeah. Why is this important to the Urban Institute at UNC Charlotte, these walks? What is it about these walks that you find, you know,
Yeah. City
valuable?
Walks provides an organized way to for people to explore Charlotte and learn about the city's past and present. These walks help connect participants to Charlotte, which is an important aim in the city of newcomers. Our hope is that participants feel more connected to their community and will continue to explore and learn about Charlotte.
Mm-hmm. And you have said, Amine, that this is a city designed for cars, mm-hmm. and people still drive everywhere, but you really don't see anything.
Exactly.
If you're in a car, you can't get a feel mm-hmm. for where you are in the car.
If you're zooming by, you miss all of the details. I didn't know my neighborhood had a large population of falcons or some kind of raptor, you know, some kind of bird of prey. Until I started walking, I'm like, ooh, that wasn't a bluebird.
Well, plus the fact it would seem to me that even if you're interested in getting out of the car and taking a look at a neighborhood, that might not be a wise thing to do unless you're in an organized walk, because people are going to look out their window and say, well, who's that? What are they up to?
True.
So you got these people going down the street with a tour guide, essentially. Mm-hmm. You get to actually see it. Mm-hmm. You feel comfortable seeing it. You learn about it.
Exactly.
How much studying do you have to do as a leader?
Well, luckily for me, I was already working at Johnson C. Smith University in the communications office. Mm-hmm. So I have to know the history of the university and therefore the history of McCrory Heights.
Okay.
So I didn't have to do too much studying on my own, but I have had to do some, you know, because McCrory Heights is an older neighborhood, yeah. You know, started in the 40s. And yeah, I've had to do some digging. But, you know, I'm also lucky in that a lot of my neighbors have been around for the entirety of the existence of the neighborhood. So I've got a lot of first person.
So as you've dug into this and as you conducted a tour last year and as you're about to do one, I think you're still about to do one this year, what about your neighborhood where you live emerged as something that you didn't know or that surprised you?
Well, what surprised me was learning basically that McCrory Heights, someone told me that McCrory Heights was the Black Myers Park, for lack of a better mm-hmm. word. I wasn't aware how many firsts have roots in McCrory Heights. And not just racial firsts, but definitely racial firsts in Charlotte. The first Black, so many things. So many important people. But also, you know, the first woman who's taught driver's ed, you know, in the city of Charlotte. The first Black school board, members, the first, so many firsts in McCrory Heights that, you know, I didn't realize that I lived in a neighborhood of giants like that.
And Tom, you mentioned that this is a neighborhood where a lot of Charlotte civil rights leaders from the civil rights era lived. How do you present that information in the context of a walk where you're going down the street? You just point the house out, so-and-so lived here?
The one from McCrory Heights, we're going to start it at the First Baptist Church West in the parking lot there on Saturday, May 5th at 10:30. We all gather. The best part of the tour, actually, is people meeting each other before the tour starts. And then that's a Harvey Gantt-designed building. And then we'll walk up a block and we'll stop in front of the Robert H. Green House. He was an African-American physician. And he was one of a group from mostly McCrory Heights who filed the lawsuit to desegregate our parks in 1951, starting with the Revolution Park Golf Course. And that's before Martin Luther King, before Rosa Parks, all of that. And so we walk a little bit, we stop, we talk. The Excelsior Club is on that tour. The amazingly beautiful campus at Johnson C. Smith is the literally the high point. It's one of the highest points in the city. And then we walk back through the neighborhood.
Do you go into places like the Excelsior Club or just talk about it as you walk?
In this particular tour, we tend to walk by.
Okay.
We also are doing a series of munching tours in older strip shopping centers. Who would ever want to walk around a strip shopping center? Well, it's a tasty thing. And there we go into the restaurants and we have a little bit of this.
I'm going to make a leap of faith here and say that's on the east side, but I also understand it's below South End,
right?
As well.
Yeah, we're doing one with the Madison Park neighborhood area in South End. We're doing one way out where Sharon Amity meets Harris Boulevard. That seems out to
that's
me way, anyway.
That's out, yeah.
A Unless couple in the there. Central Avenue Sharon Amity area. And yep.
Yeah, not all of these neighborhoods most people would consider historic. I mean, you're going to Elizabeth and you're going to, I think, Plaza Midwood and Dilworth and Myers right. Park, correct?
Right.
But not all of these neighborhoods, they're just some of those neighborhoods.
Yeah, they're tours about people making history. I think often we think that history is what happened 100 years ago or history is what made it into the history books. And Jane Jacobs said we are all making history all the time. And that is tremendously empowering because the decisions we make, the way we get to know our neighbors, mm-hmm. changes the city, makes a better city.
We're talking about Charlotte City Walks, which are about to kick off again this year. They do them every spring. Tom Hanchett is here along with Amiyane Wright and Angelique Gaines. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Charlotte's City Walks, which kick off shortly. Tom Hanchett is here, a community historian who writes the Food From Home column for the Charlotte Observer. He'll be conducting a number of these tours, including those munchie tours he talked about, where he takes you around to places that you wouldn't think of going if you're in search of food. But
yum.
But yes, but we'll see. He'll take you. Yum is English, right? Okay.
The universal language.
And Megany Wright is here. She's an assistant director of communications for Johnson C. Smith University. She's conducting one of these tours. And Angelique Gaines, social research specialist with UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. There is a website that people can go to find out when and where these tours are. What is that website?
That website is citywalksclt.org, and you could find the list of the 2018 walks there.
Yeah, some of them include, and by the way, we'll put that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks, but some of these tours, like there's a walking tour of Hebrew Cemetery and Bright Walk.
People are just dying to get into that one. it's really neat. There's one of the oldest burial grounds here is the Hebrew Cemetery on Statesville Avenue. It dates from the 1860s, and it has an expert who knows all of the folks who are buried there one way or another, Civil War soldiers and Harry Golden, the great author and humorist, and all sorts of things. And we walk through there, and then we walk over to this new mixed-income neighborhood called Bright Walk. Right. It's all by Camp North End, and we'll tell a little bit of that story as well on that one.
And there's two absolutely, definitely history walks. One's the Liberty Walk through Uptown. On MacDeck Day, for those of you who are new to town, we allegedly declared independence before the rest of the nation did on MacDeck Day, Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence Day, and the Trail of History along the Little Sugar Creek Greenway. What is the Trail of History?
Trail of History is a beautiful walk in the park. Tony Zeiss and other folks from Central Piedmont Community College and from the history community here have raised money for life-size statues of people who made a difference in our community. And some of them are people like William Henry Belk, the department store guy. Some of them are people like Thad Tate, who was a leading African-American business person at the turn of the last century. Jane Wilkes, who founded the hospitals here. And so it's a chance to explore the Little Sugar Creek Greenway, but learn some history.
Is Captain Jack on that Greenway walk?
I believe so. He's the guy on the horse. He's not Paul Revere.
That's right.
But he's the guy who took whatever it was that was signed here. Something was signed here in May of 1775. Took it up to Philadelphia.
How do you know? Well, that's another show. We're not going to talk about that. Angelique. The Urban Institute is involved in this for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that you really see these walks as something that benefits the city.
Yes.
Because it can change the way people perceive neighborhoods that they never go to.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Sure. So we took a survey of our 2017 participants, and we found that these walks are really changing attitudes and behaviors. Mm-hmm. After attending a walk, 20% of people considered living in a new neighborhood.
Really?
40% explored a new neighborhood after attending, and 47% patronized a new business. And that's just from their experience with
Which means
walks.
After the walk, they went back to the neighborhood
yes.
on their own.
Yes, and shopped and went to restaurants.
I was going to say, is that because of the munchie walks, or is that just because they like the look of the neighborhood that they'd never seen before? These tours don't just touch on history. They touch on a lot of different issues. I'm not sure who to ask this question of, but because they touch on sustainability and transportation and livability and urban planning and demographics and the impact of economic development on neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. What kind of person is most likely? Who do you see coming? I mean, because you've done these before. What kind of person seems to be attracted to these and finds out that I need to come back next year to a different walk because I really enjoyed this experience? What kind of a person is that?
NPR listeners. I'm serious. It is people who are inquisitive, who want to know more about their area, who tend to be fairly well educated, but beyond that, it's extremely diverse. We'll have retired folks. We'll have young people who are new to Charlotte, young couples who want to do something together, and people who aren't couples at all and just want to come and find the world. I've never been on one where everybody looked like me. which is a pretty impressive thing in Charlotte.
So how does it work? I mean, where do you gather? Because you're doing these in lots of different neighborhoods. And I know it's on the website, but you just show up at a specific time. And
they're free, but you've got to register. Okay. We have a limit about how many people can come along because there's only so far that the human voice carries.
Right.
And so that's why people need to go to www.citywalksclt.org and register. But once you do that, then you find out where people meet, and you come and meet there, and it's an hour, 2 hours, something like that. They're not marathons. Mm-hmm. Just wear a comfortable pair of shoes, and you'll do fine.
All right. How many different tours are there?
Currently 21, but every day we're adding a walk, so there's several in discussion already.
Really?
So.
And I think it was you, Amina, that said, I may be wrong about this, that you just kind of volunteered to conduct these tours, either because you live there or because you know something about the neighborhood. Are you vetted? Does an historian say, okay, tell me what you know?
maybe we should be, but no. I wasn't necessarily vetted. I think, you do have to... You have to be pretty confident in your knowledge of your area to be willing to do it in the first place.
One of the really cool ones that I'm looking forward to is the UNC Charlotte Botanical Garden. Did you know they had a botanical garden?
Yes, I've been there.
And Jeff Gilman is leading a walking tour of that starts at the McMillan Greenhouse on Friday, May 11th. And so there are folks who are pedigreed official experts.
Right.
But Amina knows Johnson C. Smith because she works there every day. And she knows McCrory Heights because she lives there every day.
Will that smelly flower be blooming by the time this walk has taken place? You don't know. You're giving me the quizzical look. You don't. I've stumped the historian. there's this flower that blooms every two or three years. The corpse flower. It's blooming now.
Corpse orchid.
So I'm wondering if it's going to be blooming by the time you take this walk. You walk in the room, it smells putrid, and people go gaga over it. I'm not quite – I don't understand why.
And Mike brings this up as a positive thing to attract people to the city walk.
I went to the last time it bloomed, and I just missed it by like a couple of days. I was very disappointed. We tend to choose where we live so that we live – near people like ourselves. I'm told that makes people feel safe, but it also lends to this siloing effect, which has caused us to not have a lot of social capital in Charlotte, because outside of working hours, we don't associate with each other. And Amina, you said that living in a homogenous city makes you feel unsafe.
Yes,
I've never heard anybody say that before.
Yeah, well, I'm an African American woman.
Right.
I'm a first generation. I'm an immigrant. I was born in Nigeria. I've lived in Detroit. I've lived in Miami before I moved to Charlotte, and I feel safer when I'm around a mix of people and a mix of languages. Because generally speaking, in my experience, when I'm around all the same sort of a monolithic, looking or acting group, you tend to get othered. You tend to get outsidered.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's a mix of people, everybody is more likely to see what everyone has in common.
So how do you convince people who feel exactly the opposite from you, who are more comfortable when they are in their comfort zone, that they won't be hurt by stepping out of it, at least for one of these walks?
We haven't killed anybody on any of these walks yet.
Not a one.
I just wanted to offer up a quote from a city walker. City walks are a vital exercise in building social capital, meeting people from other neighborhoods, comparing experiences, and discovering shared values created for us a broader and deeper sense of this Charlotte that we share.
We are a bright and shiny new South City, this little glittering bauble that when you see it on television, because they only show the uptown area, when you see it on television, it looks spectacular. It looks like somebody from Disney World imagined it and built it here. But I've had friends who've come to town and said, I'll take them down Tryon Street, and they'll say, what happened to old Charlotte? There's nothing old here. It's all brand spanking new. It was all built yesterday. But these tours do, in fact, feature old Charlotte. And Tom said, you've said that cities need old buildings, not museum piece old buildings, or old buildings in excellent and inexpensive state of rehabilitation, though they are fine. But what we also need are a lot of plain, ordinary, low-value old buildings, including some run-down old buildings.
What? That's actually a quote from Jane Jacobs.
You're
I wish
a heretic.
I'd said.
Oh, that's the Jane Jacobs quote?
Yeah. Well, that's where new ideas take hold. If you want to start an art gallery, if you want to start an art studio, if you want to start a new restaurant, you tend not to find the most expensive space at South Park because you can't afford it. And so if you want new ideas to take hold, if you want grassroots things to happen, if you want creativity, all those things that make a strong city, you need neighborhoods like Central Avenue. You need these old shopping centers where we go on the munching tours. Yeah. And you need an appreciation for people who have come before. One of the most exciting tours is actually a tour of what's not here. Greg Jarrell, who is an activist on the West Side, is leading a bicycle tour about urban renewal. And urban renewal back in the 50s and 60s wiped out a lot of African-American neighborhoods, a lot of low-income neighborhoods. And so he's going to look at what's not here by bicycle. Wow. It's called City Walks, but you have to walk to get to your bicycle, I guess.
And God knows there are bicycles on every corner now, so you can, you don't have to own a bicycle anymore. These will help you unsilo yourself, so you can walk into a neighborhood that you've never been to and learn about it, or one that you've driven through and thought about, but we've never gotten out of the car because you're on your way to someplace else. Is there any way to quantify, because we're so low on social capital, the impact of the last 7 years of these walks in a way that would say we are starting to make at least a tiny dent in that lack of social capital that we have?
To quantify it.
I would say the number of walks.
Okay. Yes.
Every year, more people, grassroots folks, say, hey, my neighborhood is worth showing off to folks in my neighborhood, folks out of my neighborhood, and that's pretty impressive.
What's the ideal number of people on a walk, since you've both conducted them?
For me, about 25.
Okay.
I'm a good loud talker. Folks at Hebrew Cemetery have a little microphone thing, so we can take a few more there. The munching tours, it's a few less because we don't want to overwhelm some of these little immigrant restaurants.
Right.
But citywalkclt.org, you got to sign up. They're free. The munching tours, you got to bring along a little bit of cash to pay for the food that you eat. The people who lead them are volunteers. Plan Charlotte is the force behind it.
Okay, we'll put this on our website at WFAE.org, but I think each time we've said the website, we've said it wrong. I think it's City Walks.
Yes.
CityWalksCLT.org.
Right. .org. Tom Hanchett, community historian, also writes the Food From Home column for the Charlotte Observer. Amiene Wright, assistant director of. I said your name right almost every time.
You did. I'm impressed.
Thank you. I'm amazed. Assistant director of communications at Johnson C. Smith University, and Angelique Gaines, social research specialist at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. Get on that website soon because the walks start soon. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate
Thank you,
it.
Mike.
You're welcome. Well, if you've lived in this country for a while, chances are pretty good that you've heard this song before and know the story behind it.
Hang your head, Tom Dooley, hang your head and cry. You killed poor Laurie Foster and you know you're bound to die.
People
you
have been singing about Thomas.
Roadside, then you beg to be excused. Left her by the roadside and you hit her clothes and shoes. Hang your head, Tom Dooley, hang your head and cry. Killed poor Laurie Foster, and you know you're bound to die.
People have been singing about Thomas C. Dula, a.k.a. Tom Dooley, for a century and a half. The man made some very bad choices. Ignoring his mother's advice, he chose to party and drink and run with people of bad character, eventually leading to his being hanged for allegedly murdering the girl he was supposed to marry.
You took her on the hillside for to make her your wife. You took her on the hillside, and there you took her life. You dug the grave 4 feet long and you dug it 3 feet deep. You rolled the cold clay over her and you tromped it with your feet.
Tom Dooley was hanged on Depot Hill in Statesville 150 years ago tomorrow.
At this time tomorrow, then where do you reckon I'll be? Way down yonder in a holler, hanging on a white oak tree. Hang your head, Tom Dooley, hang your head and cry. You killed poor Laurie Foster and you know you're bound to die.
Tom Dooley's story has been told through song and in other ways since 1868, and now there is the Tom Dooley Project, a celebration of the legend that has been used worldwide to teach children how to make good choices, like who to call a friend and how to make the best of our short time here. Kathy Cash is the director of the Tom Dooley Project, and she joins us now in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
Also here is video producer Bill Barnes. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Mike.
And his wife, Charlotte Corbin Barnes, has written a massive book. My Lord. She's also with us. She's the author of The Tom Dooley Files, which is already being praised as the Tom Dooley Bible, and which was recognized with the Historical Book Award for 2017 by the North Carolina Society of Historians. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
And they all drove down from Statesville this morning, which meant you left Saturday afternoon sometime, and you finally got here. Thank
yes,
you for
and
being
sat
here.
In traffic. And,
yes, you did. Before we get into Tom Dooley and the Tom Dooley Project, I have to mention that that version of the song that we just played, Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley, performed by Danny Wicker, is not the same as the Kingston Trio hit from 1958. Is Danny taking liberties with the melody, or I think the words are different too. Is this just a different song? Is this the original song that started in 1868 that the Kingston Trio trashed? Tell me the story behind
the
song.
It's based on older material. The song that the Kingston Trio used was field recorded in 1938. The third song that Frank Prophet played for the Warners in 1938 was Tom Dooley. And Ann Warner took it down as Tom Dewey instead of Tom Dooley because he was running for office, I guess, at that time. And so anyway, they took it back to New York, copyrighted it, and the Kingston Trio was at the Purple Onion in California auditioning, and the group in front of them called the Terriers, T-A-R-R-I-E-R-S, played the song. And the lead singer of the Terriers at that time was Alan Arkin, the actor, I guess, before he got his acting career going. But anyway, they were listening to the song and looked at each other and said, that's only a couple chords. We could play that drunk. And perhaps they did. I don't know. But anyway, it kind of went from there. But the song in 1938 that Frank Prophet recorded had actually been done by Grayson and Witter in 1929, and Grayson, we believe, is how the name Grayson got in the song.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk all about the Tom Dooley Project, about Tom Dooley himself, and the mystery behind why he's called Tom Dooley, because that's not his name. We'll get into that in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Tom Dooley Project because tomorrow at 2:15 in the afternoon will be the 150th year to the moment that Tom Dooley was hanged on Depot Hill in Statesville, May 1st, 1868. We're here with Kathy Cash, producer and director of the Tom Dooley Project, Bill Barnes, the video producer, and Charlotte Barnes, author of the Tom Dooley Files, which I want to talk about in a second. But who was Tom Dooley, in case people don't know? I can't imagine that they don't, but maybe they don't. Who's Tom Dooley?
Dooley was a young Confederate soldier, mm-hmm. I believe a reluctant soldier, as many were. He was born in Wilkes County in a little place at that time was called Elkville. Mm-hmm. And he joined the Confederate Army in March of 1862 and served until he was captured at Wise's Fork March 10th of 1865. And he was sent to Point Lookout, Maryland, to a prisoner of war camp, and he stayed there until June the 11th of 1865, and then had to make his way back to the mountains.
Okay. His real name is Thomas Dula, D-U-L-A. How did he become Tom Dooley? Is this easier for people to sing it? Or
well, we have had a change of opinion. It may not be mutual.
She's saying absolutely not.
Yeah.
It's recent.
Here's what we just heard from a Dula descendant. Uh-huh. I asked Margie Dula, who works in Wilkes County, where did where did the Dula or Dooley part come from? I said, did your family use the name Dooley? She said, no, he was never called Dooley until he went into the Civil War. Hmm. And he says, that's when they started calling him Dooley. And she said that when he would write, when they would write his name, they'd write Dooley, he would scratch it out and put Dula above it.
And you disagree with that?
Well, this is something.
And you're married, so this is normal.
We disagree very often. Oh, you should have seen us plant in the garden yesterday. But this is something new. I was told by the people that I interviewed when I was doing the book that it was a colloquialism done by the mountain people,
okay,
much like the Grand Ole Opry is called the Grand Ole Opry.
Yes.
And I know my grandmother used to say, I have no ID. Instead of ideas.
Right, okay.
So
right.
To me, it's a colloquialism.
You spent 30 years. This is a very thick book that you've written here. You spent 30 years researching this. Tell me, what is it about Tom Dooley and the legend behind him, the story that you would want to devote 30 years of your life to writing this book?
Well, I think it was because when I heard the song, I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was a fifth grader, and I was bedridden for 6 months with something called St. Vitus Dance.
Hmm.
It was an abscess tooth that sent a toxin to my brain and caused me to be palsied. And it also caused me to have a heart murmur. So they put me to bed for 6 months, and my mother was supposed to keep me calm so that I'd get over this heart murmur. But at that same time, my only entertainment was the radio, and the Kingston Trio came out with this song.
Right.
And I would hear that song, and I'd sing along, and I'd cry. And my mother would say, I don't understand why you're getting so upset over someone who never even existed. He is the figment of some songwriter's imagination. And I just said, I don't think he committed the murder. And she didn't believe there had been a murder.
Well, one of you says that he was convicted on purely circumstantial evidence by a jury of fellow Confederate veterans of a crime for which he was probably only an accomplice. Who said that?
I did.
You did. So why do you
believe?
Why do you believe that?
Well, even the prosecution admitted it was all circumstantial evidence. It was, as Judge Judy would say, it was hearsay.
Okay.
It was based on the testimony of one person who said she had talked to the victim right before she disappeared. And during the first trial, that was used and to convict him, but the Supreme Court threw it out because it was hearsay evidence. So he got a second trial. They presented the same evidence, and he was convicted again. But again, it was circumstantial evidence.
So I called this the Tom Dooley Project, and you, Kathy, are the producer and director of the Tom Dooley Project. What is that?
The Tom Dooley Project is a telling of the story in music, with traditional music, Piedmont blues and bluegrass, to sort of bridge between the different scenes and then the story itself. I've been in radio for a long time and telling stories.
My condolences.
Thank you very much. And I don't look my age. I think it's something about the RF preserves us. But anyway, so anyway, I love stories. I love songs that tell stories. I love anything that involves live music or live presentation. And a good friend of mine, Karen Reynolds, wrote a play years back that is actually an outdoor drama that's performed in Wilkes County, and it's called Tom Dooley, a Wilkes County Legend.
And you mentioned radio, and this is
yes.
produced and presented by WAME.
WAME Radio. We are a small, mm-hmm. privately owned radio station
one
in
the last.
States. One of the last.
Congratulations.
And we have about 30 hours of live programming every week at this point.
Good for you.
With a very small staff. Anyway, again, presenting music, sharing stories is a lot of what we do in Statesville. So we had the opportunity to take, I've had the opportunity before, several years back, to use the old courtroom mm-hmm. in the Idle County Courthouse, which is a historic building, not the courthouse where it happened, but the one immediately after. And there's a courtroom up there. And Karen had said that, hey, if you ever want to use the Statesville part, let me know. So I was talking with Steve Hill, and we were talking about, we'd had an event downtown, and we were all sitting around talking, what could we do? What could we do? What's the story that's about Statesville? And we all went, Tom Dooley. And so I asked Karen last year. She said yes in the fall. We put it together. The cast is volunteer. We are very loosely organized. We're referred to as the Tom Dooley cult in Statesville now. I think you have the Tom Dooley crew, but anyway,
Dooleyites.
The Dooleyites. But anyways, so we tell the story live with music.
This is an interesting story to me because it took place in 1868. We did not have the media culture in 1868 that we have today. And we were very, there was no radio, there was no telephone, there was nothing. So to get the word around, it took a long time and it took determination to get it around. What was it about this alleged murder in a tiny speck of a place in the middle of nowhere back then that got into the pages of the New York Times and some other papers that spread this story around the country and eventually around the world? What was so people are murdered every day. What was so fascinated?
Well, it was actually the New York Herald.
Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it was run by a gentleman, Bennett Gordon, who I believe ran the first yellow journalism.
Ah, and he, fake news.
Well, it wasn't so much fake as it was coverage of every murder that he could find.
Okay.
And so he was fascinated by this murder, and he sent a reporter down here to cover it. And that happened to be the year, 1868, happened to be the first time that the New York Herald profited $1 million.
Wow.
And it's from running stories like this.
So this former Confederate soldier, Tom Dooley, or Tom Dula, from Wilkes County, goes away to war. He comes back home after the war is over, after he spent time in a prison camp, to find his love, Ann Foster, married to another man. What happens next?
Actually, she was married before he left. But anyways, so he
the
comes back.
The story takes a darker turn.
A darker turn.
Every time you turn the page, it takes a darker turn.
So he comes back. And Anne's pretty happy married to her husband who has money. And she would probably still sort of like to hang out with Tom without changing her personal situation.
Friends with benefits.
Friends with benefits.
Absolutely.
And so in order to make her jealous, he takes up with her distant cousin. She was a cousin, Laura Foster. He's supposed to marry Laura because Laura, allegedly, in some of the versions of the story, Laura is expecting a baby.
His?
He is.
Okay.
Supposedly. So anyways, he's supposed to meet Laura and run away, and they're going to get married. Unfortunately, rather than ending up married, Laura ended up murdered.
And buried in a shallow grave. Why was he blamed for that? What led the people to think that he did it?
Lots of people were blamed for it, actually. They were passing the blame around. To me, you may think differently, but to me, I think it was because he had made a lot of enemies because Anne and Laura weren't the only ladies he kept company with. He had kept company with most everyone in Elkville and Happy Valley.
So this is these are the bad choices that we've referred to.
These are the bad choices.
He
mentions liquor, women, fighting, and bad temper as just a few of his faults.
So he plans to elope with Laura, his true love's cousin, to make his true love, Anne, jealous. They plan to elope, but they find her body in this months later in a shallow grave, stabbed through the heart, as the story goes. Meanwhile, maybe I have this wrong. Tom and Anne are already in jail. Is that true?
Correct.
Why are they in jail? It's like a soap opera.
It was, definitely.
Because of a third woman's testimony.
Also a cousin.
Another cousin.
Came down from Watauga, Pearline Foster. Anne's cousin had been hired by Anne's mother, Lottie Foster, to come down and take care of the household chores. And in the play, it also mentions that she was going to help with the wifely duties with James while she was there.
Lordy. So,
it's deeper.
Yes, it just keeps getting worse, doesn't it? Now I'm really confused.
Or better.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm confused here about something else because we keep saying that Tom Dooley is from Wilkes County.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I checked a map, Statesville is in Iredell County, is that right?
Yes, it is.
So why are you guys celebrating him? Why was he hanged in Statesville at Depot Hill in Statesville and not someplace up in Wilkes County.
He was defended by the Confederate governor of North Carolina, Zebulon Vance.
Yes.
And Zebulon Vance had the trial moved from Wilkes County into Iredale County.
To more friendly territory or
exactly.
to neutral territory, shall we say?
Well, he had not carried the mountains because there was a great peace movement in the mountains during the war. So he had not carried Wilkes County, but he had carried Iredale County by a landslide. So he moved the trial to a place where he thought he could get a jury that would be sympathetic to Tom and Laura,
Anne.
Mm-hmm. And so he had the trial moved there.
And he still lost.
Yes, that's part of the mystery.
Wow. Now, the name Grayson came up. It was a guy named, it was a Union colonel, James Grayson, mm-hmm. who brought him, this could be wrong, brought him back to Wilkes County for a fair trial.
Mm-hmm.
Where was he that he had to be brought back?
When he found out that he was going to be arrested for Laura's murder, he took off over the mountains to Tennessee. When he got to Colonel Grayson's place, he had no shoes left. So he asked if he could work out for Colonel Grayson, work long enough to buy a pair of boots.
Mm-hmm.
And so he worked there for a couple of weeks. And then the posse from Wilkes caught up with him. And when he saw the posse, he took off. And so Colonel Grayson helped the posse track down Tom.
And he told Colonel Grayson, I didn't harm a hair on that girl's head. Meanwhile, Laura Foster, the murdered girl, has been described by history as a frail, innocent girl. And you say, perhaps, but perhaps not.
Perhaps not.
I believe that she, like many people in the mountains, had a sympathy for the Union and was helping Union prisoners from Salisbury get over the mountain to where the federal troops were.
Which is why Zebulon Vance, the Confederate governor of North Carolina, called her a viper
in our
midst.
Yes.
This story is amazing.
It is.
It is.
That's why it took 27 years to gather all this information.
Now, his original conviction, as I understand it, was appealed. And he got a second trial, which led to a second conviction. So why then do, and I'm going to put words in your mouth, all
okay,
three of
go
you.
Go for it.
Why then do you all think he's innocent?
I think it was a conspiracy. I don't even think he was at the murder at the time. And I think it was done by several of the women that he was fooling around with that all thought he was in love with them.
And your book contains accounts from people who are direct descendants of the people involved in
yes.
this story. Do you trust the oral histories to be accurate?
No.
Okay, I just wanted to know.
Each one comes from a different point of view.
So, and we're almost out of time, but the Tom Dooley Project will be performed at the Old Iredale County Courthouse May 4th through 6th. May 2nd through 6th. So this is going to be a partly musical, partly drama, because
it's combined.
It's of a play moved mm-hmm. in here. Is there video? Because you're a video editor. Is there video?
No, it's just a sideline that I've had for 30 years.
I was misled. See, the story,
that's okay.
The story is even it's Byzantine even in the present day. So May 2nd through 6th at the Old Iredell County Courthouse, and you'll come away with what? Thinking that he's innocent?
You will come away with more questions than you came in with. That's the way that it is. To me, personally, the more I read, the more I find out about it, the more that I wonder, was it this or was it that, this person or that person? And the way we tell the story leaves it open for interpretation.
Kathy Cash, producer, director of the Tom Dooley Project, Bill Barnes also with us, and Charlotte Barnes, author of The Tom Dooley Files, My Search for the Truth Behind the Legend. Thank you all for being here. A little music from the actual show you're going to do.